Case number 12-5228, Keith Thomas, Appellant v. Eric H. Holder, Jr., U.S. Attorney, Real Party in Interest, and Anthony Hedgenet, Warden, Salinas Valley State Prison. Mr. Calassa for the amicus curiae, Ms. Lyons for the appellate.
May I please the court. My name is Satnam Khalsa, and I'm here as amicus to advocate on behalf of Appellant Thomas. This case is about the constitutionality of a statutory provision that prevents indigent prisoners from accessing court if they have struck out under the three strikes rule of the Prison Litigation Reform Act. 28 U.S.C. 1915G, known as the three strikes rule, bars a prisoner from filing a complaint or appeal in forma pauperis if on three or more prior occasions while incarcerated, that prisoner has brought a federal action or appeal that was dismissed because it was frivolous, malicious, or failed to state a claim upon which relief could be granted. The rule has an exception for prisoners under imminent danger of serious physical injury. While our briefs argued both that the three strikes rule is unconstitutional and that Appellant Thomas satisfies the imminent danger exception, I will focus today only on the constitutional problems presented by the three strikes rule.
Khalsa. Thank you. We do want to hear your argument on the constitutional issue, and the court obviously asked you to brief that, but could you just spend a minute on an antecedent question for me, which is the argument that the government makes, not until page 44 of its brief, that we should look at this as if it were under Rule 60B, and that we have authority, that the question before us should be, before we reach any other question, standing or the constitutional issue, should be whether or not to grant the motion to reconsider, which turns on whether or not the underlying claim has merit or is frivolous. Could you address that first?
Right.
First of all, do you agree? I take it from your brief that you do agree that that's a potentially dispositive antecedent question, right?
We agree that it is a possibly a dispositive question. However, we believe that Thomas's underlying suit may be meritorious.
Uh-huh.
You know, as he alleges in his complaint, the federal classification of marijuana as a Controlled One substance has prevented him from obtaining it to assist in his medical treatment. And so we think that in itself suggests that.
But what about the government's argument that you're seeking he's seeking mandamus, and that in view of our American for Safe Access case, that it's pretty hard to argue that that mandamus could be awarded in involving a situation with such a discretionary act.
Yes, in light of Americans for Safe Access, it would be hard for him to argue that. However, I don't think he's completely precluded from arguing that. I think that in light of the recognition in several states, I think 20 states plus the District of Columbia, recognizing the therapeutic benefits of marijuana, I think Mr. Thomas has at least a plausible claim that it does not belong on Schedule 1 of the Controlled Substances Act.
Can I ask a related question, which is there's a statutory provision which the parties haven't focused on to the extent that I can tell, but it's 1915E2, and it's at the addendum to your brief on page 2. And I'm wondering if that provision does effectively the same work as the 60B argument that the government has raised and that you agree at least is an argument, even if you disagree with the ultimate disposition of it, because that provision says that notwithstanding any filing fee or any portion thereof that may have been paid, the court shall dismiss the case at any time if the court determines that, and then goes on to say the action or appeal fails to state a claim on which relief may be granted. And so the argument there would be you have to show that the complaint states a claim on which relief can be granted, or else at any time, including at this time, the court shall dismiss the appeal. And is there a reason why that provision wouldn't govern in this situation?
Well, I think that the reason is that construing Mr. Thomas's complaint liberally, it's plausible that he does have a valid claim.
So your argument is that that standard's satisfied, not that the statutory provision doesn't apply in the first place.
Yes.
And I take it your argument is effectively the same one you were making with respect to 60B, is that he actually does have a viable claim.
That's correct.
Not that he doesn't have to show that he has a viable claim.
That's correct.
Okay.
So the first constitutional problem presented by the three strikes rule is that it violates Thomas's due process right to access the courts. Bounds v. Smith and Lewis v. Casey confirm that the Supreme Court views the right of access to courts as a fundamental constitutional right. The Supreme Court has also made clear in cases such as Griffin v. Illinois and Body v. Connecticut and MLB v. SLJ that certain rights are so fundamental and important that the imposition of court fees on indigent parties seeking to vindicate those rights results in an unconstitutional denial of due process. Because the three strikes rule imposes an insurmountable barrier for Thomas to gain court access in order to vindicate a fundamental right, the rule results in an unconstitutional denial of due process applied to him.
And can I ask another follow-up question, which is, I think, at least tangentially related to the sequence of events that your statement has thus far addressed, and that is that the government also raises an argument about standing to seek mandamus relief. And so the fundamental right that you're talking about, which ultimately is a fundamental right for Mr. Thomas to get access to medical marijuana, he has to have laid the groundwork to show that his claim actually satisfies the redressability criterion, which I think means that he has to show there's a substantial probability that if the relief he seeks comes about, then he actually will ultimately get the medical use of marijuana. But there seems to be a couple of intermediate steps that at least pose significant obstacles to him. One is that he doesn't have a prescription, and the other is that there's no indication that I can tell that the California officials, and maybe this is the more important one, and maybe you can start with this one, that the California officials who would have to give him the marijuana, the prison officials, would in fact do so if the scheduling were changed in the way that he has sought.
Right. Mr. Thomas alleges that the federal classification of marijuana, in effect, is a deterrent on California prison officials for granting him access to begin with. So our assumption is that the federal classification is a but-for factor preventing him from gaining access. Presumably, he would have to go through other steps to gain access, but a threshold barrier is the federal classification.
But doesn't he have to show a substantial probability that whatever steps would ultimately have to have been gone through, those steps will actually be gone through, or else he's not going to get the marijuana that he seeks?
Well, his complaint is not clear on all these points, but it does definitely suggest that if it but for the federal classification, he would be able to obtain medical marijuana. It doesn't go into the other factors that may also impede his access.
And why do we think that the California officials on site would care about the federal classification?
Again, that's not exactly clear from his complaint, but he does allege that dispensaries that provide medical marijuana are under risk of having their assets seized and their medical marijuana confiscated. And so we assume that federal law basically can prohibit him from gaining access to medical marijuana, notwithstanding its legality under California law.
Okay.
Thomas claims under the Due Process Clause that a denial of the relief he seeks results in the unnecessary infliction of pain and a deliberate indifference to a serious medical need in violation of his Eighth Amendment rights. He seeks relief from chronic and debilitating pain and alleges that the remedy he seeks will alleviate his pain. Now, the court in Body v. Connecticut noted that a statute or rule may be held constitutionally invalid as applied when it operates to deprive an individual of a protected right, for example, a right protected under the First Amendment. Now, if the right to obtain a divorce, which is nowhere enshrined in the Constitution, cannot be denied by a filing fee, then the same rule should apply to Eighth Amendment rights. The relevant limiting principle to Body and MLB is a principle established in cases like U.S. v. Cross and Ortwein v. Schwab, namely that a fee waiver is not mandatory when the litigant seeks mere access to economic benefits. Now, this case in Tucker v. Branker, this court, rather, in Tucker v. Branker found that the fee provisions of the PLRA did not result in a denial of due process because, among other things, a completely destitute prisoner could always proceed IFP under the Section 1915b4 safety valve, so that the sort of insurmountable barrier to bringing suit was not presented in the context of the PLRA. 1915G does impose an insurmountable barrier to an indigent prisoner who is struck out and can't meet the imminent danger exception, and thus results in a denial of due process for such a prisoner. Moreover, this court in Inouye Green and Butler v. Department of Justice acknowledged that conditions imposed on abusive filers must not be so burdensome as to deny the litigant meaningful access to the courts. We believe the three strikes rule also denies equal protection to indigent prisoners because it singles them out for discriminatory treatment, but does not disturb the IFP privilege for other members of a similarly situated class, indigent non-prisoners. We think that because the three strikes rule burdens a fundamental right, namely the right of access to court, strict scrutiny should be applied to see if
it was. Does it burden the right of access to court if he can go to state court?
Yes, it does. Because, well, in this case, Thomas can't go to state court because it's a federal mandamus action.
Okay, against the Attorney General.
Correct.
Is that your point? Okay.
Correct. So he has no state court option. Unlike plaintiffs in other cases where courts have declined to apply strict scrutiny to 1915G, such as Wilson v. Yaklich.
Mr. Hull, I think you're well over time, but we'll give you a couple minutes on rebuttal.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
We'll hear from the government.
Good morning. May it please the court.
I have a question about the structure of your brief. Are you laughing because you know what my question is?
I have a sneaking suspicion from your page 44 reference.
Right. Do you not think that's a dispositive question? In other words, you go through standing, imminent danger, and the constitutional issue, and then on page 44 you tell us that maybe we should deny the motion, and I'm curious to whether you think if we do that, we have to address any of the other issues you just spent 44 pages on.
Your Honor, I was mindful of the court's regular admonition that jurisdiction be addressed first. Uh-huh. So that's why I put the standing argument first. Uh-huh. Then I was mindful of the fact that the court had asked for briefing on a particular issue.
But do we have to address that, do you think?
I think you can choose about four different ways out of this. Uh-huh. Okay. And denial of reconsideration, while it's not provided for by any rule of federal appellate procedure, I simply offer the rule of civil procedure as a guide. But I agree with Judge Srinivasan this morning that 28 U.S. Code Section 1915E2 works just as well.
Well, but doesn't that apply to prisoners who have paid or are paying their fee? Isn't that what the language of it said? I don't have the language right here. It says, notwithstanding any other filing fee that may have been paid.
Yeah, I think that leaves open the possibility that notwithstanding any filing fee having not been paid. It doesn't rule that out.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's creative. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
Whether the court looks at it under that provision or under the general guidance that reconsideration is generally ill-advised or unnecessary.
Do you think that could mean notwithstanding any filing fee that may not have been? Why wouldn't it have said notwithstanding any filing fee paid or unpaid?
It says notwithstanding any filing fee, comma, or any portion thereof, comma,
right,
that may have been paid.
Yeah. Filing fee, the comma is a the language in the inside the commas, right? Now those are commas, right? No. I mean, may have been paid refers to both.
Was there any reason to think that the provision wouldn't apply in a B4 case, where by hypothesis no fee would have been paid?
I can't see any from the plain language of the statute.
Right. So for this, for E2 to make sense in a B4 case, it must encompass situations in which no fee has been paid.
Yes. The only qualification might be in a case where the court has waived the fee entirely because the prisoner is under imminent danger of serious physical injury. That's the only exception I can see. It's a possibility.
But I guess one question is, Judge Tittle obviously raises a very important point about the text. Do you see it, if 1915E2 does apply, and there is a textual question as to whether it does, is there a difference between the 1915E2 argument and the 60B argument?
Not a meaningful one, Your Honor. They both focus on maybe the first thing to do before you go through the entire exercise and approach a constitutional question that ordinarily courts don't look to resolve if it's unnecessary to do so. The first thing to do in this type of situation under either framework is to see whether it's worth doing, whether there's a legitimate claim of any kind down below. And here there is not. As the court's already discussed somewhat, Mr. Thomas lacks standing to seek mandamus to have the Attorney General reclassify marijuana under the Controlled Substances Act because that his classification is neither the cause of his inability to obtain marijuana in prison, nor is it redressable by a favorable decision of the courts.
But don't we have an obligation to construe his petition, especially since he's pro se, in the light most favorable to him? And the argument we just heard from your counterpart is that he alleges that it's a but-for situation. So why is that not the case?
Two responses. One is that at the time this case was filed in March 2012, Mr. Thomas offered no facts to support the notion that it was a but-for cause, that there is such a direct relationship between the classification of the drug and California prison officials and their actions or refusals to allow him access. The second answer is that in 2013, which is after the district court ruled in this case, this court negated whatever possibility there was by holding that the Attorney General has no clear duty to reclassify marijuana based on the current scientific evidence. And because E2, at least, says that focuses at any time, this is the time that so the court can recognize its judicial decision has removed whatever theoretical plausibility the claim may have had. And there's a difference in the mandamus context between plausibility and clear duty. Mandamus is an extraordinary remedy, and a clear duty is a high standard indeed. And so my opposing counsel's suggestion that the claim was plausible doesn't match the requirements for the particular kind of claim that Mr. Thomas brought here.
Were you done? Yeah, okay. Could I take you to the constitutional question for a second? And the amicus says that this case is virtually controlled by our decision in In re Green. That when you look at In re Green's a binding circuit precedent, and the facts of In re Green are indistinguishable from this case, and the PLRA three strikes provision is unconstitutional. What do you think about that?
Well, obviously, I disagree.
Yeah, I knew that.
I'll be happy to elaborate on why.
Sure.
What we're talking about here is effective access to the courts, and the three strikes provision removes a privilege, not a right, to avoid having to prepay the fees associated with the cost.
Say that again. It does what?
It removes the privilege.
But isn't the consequence of it that he has no access to the courts?
No, Your Honor, that is not.
It's not?
That is not the result. He is unable to bring this action, a mandamus action against the Attorney General, until he's able to come up with the filing fee.
And how's that different from In re Green?
In terms of practicality, there isn't a great deal of difference there, but that's not the end of the matter. Here, as Judge Srinivasan points out, the state court should be available for this, and there are
In Green, he had filed many cases in other courts. That had happened in Green. He had filed cases everywhere. That's why he got sanctioned.
Yes, but it's the removal of a privilege and not a right that is the difference here.
Well, wasn't it equally the removal of a privilege there? The privilege there was the ability to litigate without the payment of fees because he was deemed to have IFP status, and the court order that was at issue there denied that privilege. So why is this case more of a privilege case than Green?
I guess it's not. It's more that it's the court order there that was the source of the removal of the privilege, and so here it's a statute.
Wait. So that Green said the court order in that case violated the Constitution because it denied effective access to the courts. Is it the government's position that that constitutional provision would not apply? That constitutional principle would not apply to a statute that did the same thing?
It applies, but in this context, it doesn't apply in the same manner.
And how is that?
The statute contains an important safety valve for not denying all access to the courts without prepayment.
But let's assume you're right that doesn't apply to Thomas. But your argument in the brief is that he doesn't qualify for that.
That's correct. We don't believe that under the record in this case.
And he's only arguing that the statute's unconstitutional as applied to him. So if you're right that he doesn't qualify for any exceptions, would you agree that he is completely barred from access to the federal courts?
No.
No? How could he bring a case, this case in the federal courts? He could pay the fee, right?
He could pay the fee.
Okay.
And he should be barred from bringing this case because this case is frivolous. But the statute removes the privilege he, based on his conduct, mm-hmm. It's not a situation that is an absolute bar. It's a result of conduct.
I'm surprised that I haven't heard you mention the Hurt v. Social Security Administration case, where our circuit in 2008 said that Green had effectively been overruled by the Supreme Court.
Thank you, Your Honor. I had looked at that yesterday, but I had forgotten that point. That is obviously something that needs to be considered. I'm not familiar with it enough now to go beyond that. I apologize.
Okay.
I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Yes, you are.
If there are no further questions.
No.
Okay. No further questions, we ask that the court deny reconsideration.
Does counsel have any more time left? Mr. Costa, you can take 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. We think this court decided Green correctly.
What do you think about the question Judge Wilkins just asked?
We think that Hurt is a different situation. Hurt says that based on a litigant's abusive pattern of filing frivolous or malicious lawsuits, and based on the number, frequency, content, and disposition of an individual litigant's past filings, it is proper to impose a burden on that particular litigant's ability to proceed in former pauperis in future cases. And what a federal court...
In future cases?
In future cases. Uh-huh. By revoking IFP privilege for a particular litigant, that prohibits that litigant from proceeding IFP in future cases.
But isn't that what happened here? Isn't that what happens here?
No, because Mr. Thomas is prohibited from proceeding in future cases under a federal statute that cuts way too broadly. What a federal court might do to curb abuse in one situation is different from a federal statute that paints with much too broad a brush. In particular, the fact that 1915G issues a strike for a failure to state a claim dismissal shows that it is way overbroad to address a problem that it seeks to address.
But what if we can look at the public records and see that your client has had at least 6 cases dismissed for frivolousness?
Well, under Hurt, it might be appropriate to enjoin this particular litigant, but 1915G is unconstitutional as applied to him because it presents an insurmountable barrier for him to bring suit to access federal court.
What about the existence of B-4? Does that distinguish it from Green? Because under B-4, there's at least some fail-safe that says that a prisoner is not going to be prohibited from bringing an action at all based on the fee payment requirements.
Not if he has three strikes. B-4 doesn't help him if he has three strikes.
Okay.
We would ask this court to grant Mr. Thomas IFP status to proceed. Thank you.
Mr. Kalsa, the court appointed you as amicus. You've done a fine job, and we're grateful to you for your assistance.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yeah. Thank you.